And I would make a special request. I'm going to carry these devices. I just have a very, very, very sensitive person, and I'd ask you please to either one of two possibilities: turn it off. That's a very good option, or just put it in your pocket and leave it in your pocket. But any such devices for me, it's very, very distracting. It gets me off track. And if please, you could accommodate that. That would be excellent. Okay, I want to share with you what I consider to be a very, very important message. Mrs. Olenek, I'm going to apologize in advance for what I have to say, but it is what it is, okay? What I'd like to do is I wanted to share with you a very, very short Dvar Torah on the parasha and use that as a jumping point. This is a very, very famous Beis HaLevi. On this week's parasha, Beis HaLevi was, of course, the great-grandfather of Soloveitchik, and he points out the following difficulty. When Yaakov Avinu is fearful of his life, Esav is armored with 400 men, seemingly ready to wage war, and Yaakov Avinu devises a strategy. He's fearful, and the Torah says when he's fearful, he says, the Torah writes, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od, he's very much afraid, Vayitzer Lo, and he's very much afraid. And Rashi is already sensitive why the doubling up of the Lashon. Why does it say twice, he's afraid, and he's afraid? And Rashi gives his answer, but again, why this doubling? He's obviously profoundly afraid. And then in Pasuk Yud Beis, the Torah tells us that he davens to Hashem. He has a three-pronged strategy. He's going to divide the camp, he's getting ready for war, and he is going to daven to Hashem. And in his daven to Hashem, he says as follows, Hatzileni no, miyad achi, miyad Esav. Please, Hashem, save me from my brother, from Esav. And the obvious question is, how many brothers did Yaakov Avinu have? One brother. So why the duplication? Why not just say Esav or just say Achi? Why do we go ahead and say Hatzileni na miyad Achi miyad Esav? That seems to be superfluous, duplicative, and therefore unnecessary. Comes along the Beis HaLevi with a very, very big Esav. Is Yaakov was sensitive to two very different guises Esav, his arch enemy, could take. Esav could come and approach him as Esav, armed with 400 men to wage war, ready to do battle, and he davens to Hashem, save me from Esav, my arch enemy. That's one approach that Yaakov was concerned about, was fearful about. That was his first vayira, his fear. But Esav could simply take a different approach in dealing with Yaakov. He could come as his brother. Come, let us be friends. Let us make peace. Let us walk arm in arm. And as a result of that strategy, which could just as well be a strategy to undermine Yaakov, let's walk arm in arm. Yaakov thereby could let his defenses down and thereby also succumb to the wily attack of brother Esav. In other words, our enemies sometimes could attack us very frontally and tell us exactly who they are. I'm Esav coming to kill you, to destroy you, to attack you, and that requires one kind of defense mechanism. And then you could have another approach that an Esav could take. The approach of, let's make peace. Let's be friends. Let us work together. But in that fashion, all of a sudden, Yaakov could equally be undermined in terms of his values. The Beis HaLevi says Mitzrayim did the exact same thing. Because Chazal tell us, Avodas Parech, they spoke to the Jews Bepeh Rach, in a soft voice, in a calm voice. Let's just work on our economy together. And gradually, step by step, through Perach, through soft voice, they started to begin this process of persecution. And indeed, you look at the subsequent Pesukim, Chazal understands that when there seems to be a reconciliation, and Esav comes and approaches with a big hug, Vayishakehu, and he kisses Yaakov. So what do you find on the on top of those letters, Vayishakehu, his kiss? You have these dots. And Chazal understand, therefore, this was not a simple brother-to-brother kind of kiss. Chazal understand maybe there was something else going on, which was a what? A bite, an attack. He's coming in love, coming as a brotherly kiss, but underneath the surface was a much more subtle and insidious attack And this is something that Yaakov also prays for. And many have suggested, for example, just evaluating current modern Israeli history. And you look at us here in the Middle East, and you look at from the turn of the century, the last century, up until perhaps, one might argue, today, our approach, our enemies around us here in the Middle East have taken an approach of Esav, terrorism, warfare, attack, and have made very, very clear what their agenda is to push the people of Israel into the Mediterranean. But then more recently, perhaps, they have seen that that strategy was not really working. And then when it was a matter of waging war, Hashem was on Klal Yisrael's side and pushed the enemy back and actually regained territory and so forth. So in recent years, we find perhaps a different strategy. No longer a strategy of Esav. But let's walk arm in arm. Let's shake hands on the White House lawn. Let us make peace. Let us work together. When perhaps, in fact, it's the same exact end game with a different type of strategy. And many have also pointed out that we have seen in the past 100 years a tremendous, tremendous loss to our people. Tremendous, tremendous loss to our numbers. Most obviously in Nazi Germany, where the Nazis, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, took a very, very clear approach on what his attitude and his approach dealing with, if you will, the Jewish problem was going to be. The final solution, 6 million of our brothers and sisters dying to the hands of Esav, in your face, very, very clear. But some have pointed out as well that the world around us, the culture around us, the Western culture, the melting pot that we all live in, we all come from, has produced as an equally insidious attack on our people. Not an attack of a physical destruction, that's the Esav, but perhaps our brethren around us, our society around us, embracing us, bringing us within their midst, not intentionally necessarily, but embracing us, and all of a sudden, how many Jews in the past 60, 70 years have we lost to assimilation? Where our brothers and sisters are leaving the fold, are leaving their heritage, their religion, their Judaism, because of not the Esav, but this time it's the Achi. It's the same Romi, this Western culture. Sometimes it comes in a very clear, blatant attack, and sometimes it's far more subtle. But when you're talking about subtlety, so it's perhaps much more dangerous because your guards get let down, and you don't realize what's happening as it's happening, and all of a sudden, we're losing people left and right, assimilation, people going off the derech, and it's all because of the same phenomena. Esav now wearing the mask of Achi. And I would like to make this relevant to us, because last year, I just want to share with you, Rav Schechter came here to speak, and in his speech, somehow the question of universities came up, and he said something very, very radical. And in his radical expression, I think he lost his message. Maybe he didn't lose his message. Maybe I missed his message, and it's exactly the message that I'm going to share with you today. But he said the problem of certain universities is the problem of intermarriage. And yeshiva boys go to universities and go to this place and that place, and 2 years later, 3 years later, they're dating Gentiles and they're intermarried. And I said to myself as I was listening to this drasha, this answer, he's going too far. He's taking it too far, because you look around the room of yeshiva boys, that's not the issue. Intermarriage is not the problem. But I'll tell you what I believe is the problem. And you can ask yourself, and I ask you, to think very deeply about what I'm going to speak about, what I'm going to share with you, because so many of our youth, and I speak about, when I say our youth, I speak about the people in this room, but I speak much more broadly than that, are living a Yiddishkeit that is uninspired, that is passionless, that is emotionless, that is a void of any real energy. And I ask you, to consider with me what exactly happened. Why is it that so many, you think back, I see so many boys come in and you ask them when they're in high school, davening doesn't mean anything to them. And learning Torah doesn't mean anything to them. And this mitzvah or that mitzvah doesn't mean anything to them. And then you read articles in places like the Jewish Week, where so many Orthodox kids are texting on Shabbos, and Shabbos doesn't mean anything to them. And it is just a very rote, perfunctory, robotic kind of Avodas Hashem, devoid of any meaning. So it's not maybe intermarriage, but we should talk a little bit about the word assimilation. Because I took the time this afternoon to look up the word assimilation. And when we think about assimilation, we think about intermarriage. But assimilation means something very different. It means to absorb, to assimilate a value system, to assimilate ideals, concepts, and thereby potentially adulterate and dilute who we are and perhaps who we can be. Yaakov Avinu, when he confronts Esav, tells him, "Im Lavan garti, I lived with Lavan for all these years," and Chazal said so profoundly and so beautifully, "Im Lavan garti," flip the letters, "despite the fact I lived 20 years in Golos, 20 years in the house of Lavan, Taryag mitzvah shamarti, I kept the Taryag." But then Chazal add a few extra words. "V'lo lamadati mima'asav hara'im," and I didn't learn from his evil ways. Which means, you can keep Taryag mitzvahs. You can keep every one of the mitzvahs. And you could still learn from the ways of Lavan. And Yaakov is making two points. Number one, I kept the mitzvahs, 100%. But number two, is not only that, by my hashkafa, my value system, my outlook on life, was a Jewish outlook, was a Yaakov outlook, was the outlook of Yitzhak and Avram, and I did not adopt the hashkafa of Lavan. How many years have most of us been in yeshivas? I mean, Jewish education. Phil Katz does not count. Approximately 12 years. Most of us have been in Jewish schools, yeshiva education, for 12 years. Most of us, in those 12 years, probably studied Torah and Torah subjects for a good 3 hours a day for 12 years. And at the same time, at least, and at the same time, we're also involved in our secular knowledge, our secular education. Now, if I were to go ahead and give you all a test, which I'm not going to do, if I were to ask you where you're holding in terms of your knowledge of secular information, secular knowledge, secular education, most of you coming from good schools, coming with good educations, you've taken AP courses already in high school. You're on a high level in mathematics, a high level of sciences, a high level of English. You're very, very sophisticated on your SAT scores or your standardized tests. Most of you are probably in the serving the 70th, 80th, 90th, and even higher percentile. It's impressive. Very, very good work. On the other hand, you've invested, your parents have invested $25,000 a year for 12 years, $300,000. Part of that in your Jewish education. And you have a Jewish education, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. But if you ask yourself, your knowledge, your proficiency in Talmud, in Chumash, in Nach, in Halach, and you match it up to your proficiency in mathematics, in sciences, in secular knowledge, you're very proficient. I can give you a piece of literature, a hard piece of literature. And you know what? Most of you will get through it and understand it. I can give you a piece of Gemara. And we're struggling, we're fighting. It's really, really difficult. Our knowledge bekiyas in Nach, in Halacha, unfortunately, we're not really holding as well as we should be with all the investment of time and money that we put in. Phil, how do you feel?
No comment.
No comment.
Forget
there was a 12th grade Rebbe in one of the high schools. Someone I respect a lot. Every single year, he gives his 12th graders a test. Two tests, actually. One test is on what he calls the pop culture test, the 10-question test. And he asks questions on pop culture. What team did Wayne Gretzky play for? Name me three songs that Britney Spears sings. I don't want to hold it. Anyway, who won last year's Super Bowl? And invariably, his students on these pop culture tests score 8, 9, 10 out of 10. And then he gives them what he calls Jewish kind of general knowledge kind of questions. In what century was the Mishnah Berurah written? No answers. Who was Rabbi Yechezkel Lindau? What well-known yeshiva was the Netziv associated with? Basic Jewish question. And invariably his 12th grade students in this school would get on the Jewish, not trivia, just basic knowledge, would score approximately 2 or 3 out of 10. And it's very striking. And it's very interesting that in terms of our adoption, our assimilation of the culture around us, we've absorbed a tremendous amount. And if you ask me, in my humble opinion, why it's tough for us to get inspired, why sometimes our youth find Judaism a little bit flat and they're not connecting, is because we're connecting to something else and we're assimilating something else and we're off course in a very, very serious way. As I mentioned last week, I want to share with you some striking... I want to read you an article, not a whole article, but a piece of an article. This is written in New York Times, September 16th, 1999. This is old information. And it's talking about a community in the United States of America, Orthodox community, and it talks about kind of the world that we all come from. The new wave of young families, men who both pray and pump iron before work, women with a cell phone at their ear and a baby at their breast, youngsters in rollerblades and yarmulkes, are inventing a style of Jewish life that blends rituals of orthodoxy with the rituals of the mall, the gym, and the LIRR. And he describes some anecdotes in this article when a person's daughter, Miss Markovich's daughter, at the age of 5, wanted to dress like one of the Spice Girls. You know what that is? So Miss Markovich told her, not everything is for everybody. But let her 5-year-old girl keep watching MTV. When her son at 7 rebelled at covering his head with a yarmulke while eating, she let him substitute a baseball cap. A rabbi of one of the shuls, describes, I'm just quoting from the article, I won't name the shul or the rabbi, but he preaches in his wealthy community of Lawrence that be vigilant for the sin of shallowness, even as he permits co-ed dancing and strapless dresses at temple affairs. And the specter of shallowness, the article writes, haunts these families. The challenge that we find ourselves when we're trying to inculcate real Torah values in our kids, in our youth, in our children, when our children idolize people like the Spice Girls. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, the world that you grew up in is a very, very different world than the world your parents grew up in, and certainly your grandparents grew up in. Again, just a quick chazar. I mentioned the high school principals. In 1940, we surveyed what's your biggest problems. And different principals in the 90s were surveyed what's your biggest problems in running your public schools. In the 1940s, the top 7 problems: talking out of turn, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, breaches of the dress code, littering, and cutting in line. In the 1990s, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, teenage pregnancy, suicide, rape, robbery, and assault. In the past 30 years, illegitimate births are up 400%. single parent households have tripled. Divorce rates have more than doubled, and now they're in excess of 50%. Teenage suicide is up 300%. SAT scores are down 73 points. The number one health problem for women in the United States today is domestic abuse. 4 million women per year. One quarter of adolescents contract sexually transmitted diseases before they finish high school. Households with a parent at home is down. From 30 years ago, where two-thirds of the households had a parent at home, not working, today 16% have one household member at home, meaning both parents are working. The average child today is watching 8 hours of TV a day. The average time he spends with his father is 5 minutes a day. With his mother, 20 minutes a day. From the time kids graduate high school, they watch 13,000 hours of television. Sorry, take it back. 16,000 hours of television, and they've been in school 13,000 hours. So they spend a lot more time in front of the TV than in school. In grade school on TV, this is a little bit old, they've witnessed 8,000 murders, 100,000 acts of violence. And studies have indicated that for every 4 hours, kids who watch 4 hours or more of TV a day have a double chance, double their chance for smoking, obesity, and other problems. It's a tough world that we live in, and it's a world that has infiltrated our community, our society. We ask ourselves, you know, what exactly is going on? And again, I'm just going to share with you, I'm talking a little bit about TV, but it goes beyond TV. But just again, I pulled some articles off the internet, which we'll come to in a second. An article in the Los Angeles Times, in the business section, 2005. Television remains so awash in sex that 7 in 10 episodes include some kind of racy content. 91% of comedies have sexual content in it, 87% of dramas, 73% of news magazine shows. Last year, a Rand Corp surveyed 1,800 adolescents, and they found that teens who watched a lot of sexually suggested TV shows were almost twice as likely to have sex earlier than teens who didn't. And then, the Tony Perkins, head of the Family Research Council, writes as follows. The sex depicted on television does have an effect on kids. If we are what we eat, then we become what we watch. This has a lot of impact on us. The world around us impacts us in a very, very profound way. I just want to read you something that just, again, it makes me, I'm uncomfortable reading it, but I think it just has to be written in this, set in this context. Again, I'm reading from a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families, page 16. And again, this is part of the world that we have grown up in, and the world, therefore, that poses for us a very, very fundamental challenge. He says he had a conversation, Stephen Covey did, with a man whom I consider a very good father. He told me this story. His 7-year-old son recently seemed to have some things on his mind. He said, "Dad, I just can't quit thinking about it." And this father assumed that it was a nightmare or some kind of scary movie he had seen. But after a lot of persuasion and some coaxing, he told of horrible, ugly, hardcore pornography that he'd been exposed to. The father said, "Where did this come from?" The boy gave him the name of a 9-year-old neighbor, a trusted neighbor. He had seen it on the computer. "How many times did you see it?" the father asked. "Lots of times," was the reply. Well, the father went to the parents of the 9-year-olds. They were shocked. They were dismayed. They were sickened to think that the minds of these two little boys had been polluted at their tender age. The parents of their 9-year-old confronted him. He collapsed in tears. And he said, "I know it's wrong, but I just keep looking at it." They were concerned, of course, there might be an adult involved, but no. It was introduced to the 9-year-old boy by a 6th grader who gave him the internet address in school and said, "Look at this, it's really cool." And it spread around the neighborhood like a plague. The father told me that they had encouraged their children, as they felt they should, to learn to use the computer. And the 9-year-old was good at it, but they kept the computer downstairs behind a closed door. And unwittingly, they had turned that room into a porn shop. kids and alcohol, a big, big problem in our world, in the world out there. Again, 1993, this old news. 1/3 of high school seniors, 1/4 of 10th graders, and 1/7 of 8th graders drink at least once every 2 weeks. Where are they learning how to drink? Where are they getting this from? Where is it coming from? It's come from a lot of places. But it's a lot coming from our culture. And where does our culture come from? So again, there's a very fine book called To Kindle a Soul by Lawrence Kellerman, who has a chapter devoted to these matters. And he writes over here, in a 1982 report of the Surgeon General, he writes, the Surgeon General observed, revealed that alcohol is the most consumed beverage on primetime TV shows. Television characters, 82, drink alcohol twice as often as they drink tea or coffee, 14 times as frequently as soft drinks, and 15 times more often than water. 80% of primetime programs showed or mentioned alcohol consumption, and a half of these instances was heavy alcohol consumption, 5 or more drinks. And it goes through all the average U.S. citizen, 100,000 television advertising for alcoholic beverages before the age of 21. It seems reasonable to suspect that TV exposure might affect our children's drinking habits. A New Zealand research group found that the amount of TV exposure of kids in New Zealand from 13 to 15 impacted directly the amount they drank 3 and 5 years later when they were 18 years old. Each year students spend $5.5 billion on alcohol in the United States of America, more than they spend on soft drinks, tea, milk, juice, coffees, and books combined. On a typical 60% of young women diagnosed with sexually transmitted disease were drunk at the time of infection. On a typical weekend in America, an average of 1 teenager dies every 2 hours in a car crash involving alcohol. Children who drink recreationally are 7.5 times more likely to use an illicit drug and 50 times more likely to use cocaine than children who abstain from alcohol. Sexual activity and the amount of our youth around us involved in sexual activity, again, there's a direct relationship, many, many studies that correlate what we witness, what we are exposed to. For example, again, without going into too many details, in the 70s, the TV shows that involved or, you know, had sexual kind of connotations and scenes were of a humorous or romantic type of nature. And things changed in the 80s, especially with the advent of MTV that began the change in kind of this kind of culture in this area. And all of a sudden, sexual references, innuendos, and so forth. There's a television show I asked my shir the other day. On Shabbos, we had a little family feud. I asked them what their favorite TV shows were. So, We got two answers, which, again, there were a lot of answers. It was a lot of fun. And so one of the answers was, what's it called? I'm not really holding it. Two and a half. Two and a half men. So again, from what I understand, one of the main characters in the show celebrates is a celebration of his promiscuity. And that character, what's his name, Charlie? His real life. Like, his character in the show became his real life, you know? Like, he's, like, involved in ridiculous drug use and ridiculous promiscuity, and it's like it was an alter ego. Like, it is like transfers that took place. And this show called, seems like an innocuous kind of the name of a show. How I Met Your Mother. So it lauds, it celebrates promiscuity and not relationships, but rather the character in the show who is all about the antithesis. But to think that does not filter into who we are and what we are is a very, very big mistake. I want to tell you something. This unbelievable study that was done, this to me is the most, two more studies on Unbelievable. There's a South Pacific island called Fiji. They only received electricity on this island in 1985. Only in 1995 was TV brought to the island. So it's a good place to study because they had a before and after, where there was no TV and then TV. At the time TV came to Fiji, a large physique was the norm and was considered beautiful by Fijian standards. A woman who was a full-bodied woman was considered to be beautiful. According to the study, Becker, few Fijians were dieting, and eating disorders were very, very rare. After 3 years of television and shows like Seinfeld, ER, Melrose Place, Xena, Warrior, Princess, and Beverly Hills 90210, 74% of Fiji's teenagers started feeling they were too big or fat, and 62% started dieting. Which, again, a direct correlation, what we watch, what we see, and what goes on. And one last thing that I want to share, and then we'll go to my next point. And watch, where is this? Watch this. Really amazing thing. Amazing, amazing thing. I have seen. Any Rabbeim here? Varnals? How long have you been in the business?
A decade.
I've been in the business about 16 years, a little longer, and I've observed an amazing thing. The attention span of my students is like, it's really like from 16 years ago to 10 years ago to 5 years ago to 3 years ago to 2 years ago, and then this. The attention span of the students, have you noticed a decrease in attention span?
I guess I noticed the this year thing.
So, it's something I've noticed very, very clearly. Now, we have, Baruch Hashem, very talented students, bright boys, but there's something happening with the attention span. So what's happening? So I for sure believe the internet and surfing and all of the technology definitely has something to do with it, and certainly what we, TV and the like, also has something to do with it. Listen to this paragraph. Television's quick cuts alleviate the need to concentrate. George Comstock explains, the pacing of much television suppresses impulse control and the ability to tend to the slower pace of schooling. New York University's Neil Postman reports that the average length of a shot on a network television is only 3.5 seconds. So the eye never rests, always has something new to see. Robert McNeil, executive editor and co-anchor of the McNeil-Lehrer Hour, News Hour, writes that the idea is to keep everything brief, not to strain the attention of anyone, but instead to provide constant stimulation through variety, novelty, action, and movement. You're required to pay attention to no concept, no character, and no problem for more than a few seconds at a time. Back in 1854, there was a big debate between two presidential candidates, Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas. Douglas led off with a 3-hour opening statement, which Lincoln took 4 hours to rebut. 1987, presidential debates. Each candidate took 5 minutes, and today, now it's like 2 minutes, to address questions like, what is your policy in Central America, before the opponent went off on a 30-second rebuttal. It's like a parody of intellectually taxing presentations. One last study, and then where do we go from here? So one of the challenges of these things is the medium itself is a medium that kind of encourages passivity. And therefore, there's a great correlation between computer sitting, TV sitting, and obesity. And a lot of Americans, for example, are obese because they spend a lot of time sitting in front of these screens. And a study was done in 1993 by the University of Tennessee and Memphis State University monitoring metabolic rates in 8 to 12-year-old children under two conditions. One condition was lying down in a dark room. The second condition was sitting up watching television. And you know what they found? An unbelievable thing. In every case, the child's metabolic rate while sitting and watching television was far lower than his metabolic rate while lying down in the dark. Which means, watching television is worse than doing nothing. Unbelievable. What's the shot? I don't know. But that's what comes out of this study. I don't get it, but that's what comes out. Gentlemen, this is the world that we all live in. I've described here the problem. And anyone who wants to get up and deny the problem, I think is being very naive. Being very silly. It's a problem. And we talk about how do we inspire, how do we get into things, how do we appreciate davening and so forth. I'm describing a problem that we all have and we all have to deal with. And it's a problem that, in my mind, I'm not going to give you all this, I'm not going to give you solutions to this problem, but it's important to understand the problem. And I want to just give you a muscle, because understanding the problem is a very, very important piece of the puzzle. And it's not your fault. I don't blame anyone. You didn't have a chance. We don't have a chance. You know, too much. There was too much competition. There's too much distraction. There's too much clutter that just pulls us away from our what we should be focused on. And we've lost sensitivity. We've lost our sensitivity of what is really, really going on. The muscle that's given, I don't know if it was a true experiment, but it was written up of a someone who took a frog and had a frog and had this boiling hot pot of water. Took the frog and put it into the boiling hot pot of water. And you know what happened? The frog jumped right out. And then phase two of the experiment is they took the frog and put it in a cold pot of water. And then they turned on the flame on low heat. And slowly the pot warmed up and got warmer and warmer and warmer and hotter and hotter and hotter. And the frog swimming around and starts to get weaker and weaker and weaker and then dies. What happened? Frog in phase number one jumps right out. Frog number two turned on the heat a little bit and slowly but surely becomes paralyzed, weaker and weaker and weaker, and then perishes. So it's obvious. Because when it's a steady process of absorbing into that environment, you don't even realize what's going on around you. The frog is no longer sensitive to what's happening to him, and therefore doesn't have the strength to extricate himself from what's going on, and therefore starts to lose his energy, weaker and weaker, until there's nothing left. Unfortunately, that's a good description, a good mashal, of our state of not so inspired, not so uplifted, because we're in this world, the whole wide world, where the culture and we've been bombarded with things that are just weakening us and weakening us and weakening us, and sometimes you don't have the otzmah, the strength and the power to just jump out and look at things afresh. It's tough. It's a very, very tough thing. I want to read to you, and with this I will read towards my conclusion. There's a very, very fine book called The Road Less Traveled. And he's not discussing our issue at all, but I think his message is a very, very important message. And I'm going to make an editorial comment before I read what he writes. This is not my direction here, but one might argue, one might suggest, you know what, maybe the Haredi world is onto something. To be living in a more cloistered, protected environment, in a cocoon, where the onslaught of the secular world around me is not infiltrating my home, my hashkafa, my worldview. Maybe they're onto something. Maybe it's not 100% war, which allows perhaps their children to not be subject to the challenge, the very, very dire, paralytic challenge that many of us face. Something to think about. I'm not giving you my opinion on that right now, but it's definitely, if we think what's the svar, what is the logic of that approach? There is some logic to the approach. Mature mental health demands an extraordinary capacity to flexibly strike and continually restrike a delicate balance between conflicting needs goals, duties, responsibilities, and directions. The essence of this discipline of balancing is giving things up. I remember first being taught this one summer morning in my ninth year. I had recently learned to ride a bike and was joyously exploring the dimensions of my new skill. About a mile from my house, the road went down a steep hill and turned sharply at the bottom. Coasting down the hill on my bike that morning, I felt my gathering speed to be ecstatic. To give up this ecstasy by the application of brakes seemed an absurd self-punishment. So I resolved to simultaneously retain my speed and negotiate the corner at the bottom. My ecstasy ended seconds later when I propelled a dozen feet off the road into the woods. I was badly scratched and bleeding, and the front wheel of my new bike was twisted beyond use from the impact against the tree. I had lost my balance. Balancing is a discipline precisely because the act of giving something up is painful. In this instance, I had been unwilling to suffer the pain of giving up my ecstatic speed in the interest of maintaining my balance around the corner. I learned, however, that the loss of balance is ultimately more painful than the giving up required to maintain, balance. In one way or another, it is a lesson I continually had to relearn throughout my life, as must everyone. For as we negotiate the curves and corners of our lives, we must continually give up parts of ourselves. And no doubt, we would love to embrace everything and do everything and be the best Jew possible and the best 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid possible and get it all in. The answer is it does not work. You cannot. And if you want the ecstatic speed, know, coming down that hill, know that there is very well likely a crash landing at the bottom. And a person to achieve balance has to give things up, has to slow down, and has to realize that balance means giving some things up. Giving up on some things for your benefit, for what is going to propel you much further, keep you on that bicycle, and it's going to be with you, Be'ezrat Hashem, for the rest of your lives. So as you go ahead and think about Yaakov, and as he's davening for Esau, against for the challenge of Esau, if you ask me, yeah, Esau is a real challenge. Hatzileni na. But be careful about Achi, because Achi is much more subtle. Achi is something you're not at all, you don't see coming. It's subtle, it's the flame raised up on that pot as it slowly gets hotter and hotter, warmer and warmer. And before you know, you've lost the ability to extricate yourself. You've lost the ability to jump out. Achi is what we have to be very, very wary of. And I want to give everyone a very, very special brother that they should live lives like Yaakov Avinu, a life of true success, as we've talked about, both in this world and the next. We navigate not only the Esavs around us and successfully overcomes their challenges, but also sees the Achi for what he is, for the challenge he poses, and also overcomes him. Before I close, one last thing that's very, very important. It's been brought to my attention, and I just think it needs to be dealt with and needs to be heard by everyone. An example, I don't know if it's today.